Antisthenes 4. Of course he had known I was coming. He had been expecting me. He fed me. I had never eaten cooked flesh until then. It made me feel sick and giddy. He had clothing and blankets. He helped me to wash, and he helped me to dress. I went to sleep when he covered me. And I think I slept all the rest of the day, all the night, and into the next day. And when I awoke, I found they had carried me, and we were in the ruins of an ancient dwelling beside the river, in a bedroom, in a bed, in a house, on the topmost floor of it, overlooking the river. And as I lay there, I heard other voices than his. This is how I found the village. Grandfather once texted this about life in the village. This is the human scale. What should be good for you lies no further from you than the length of your arm. What you need is at your grasp. What you hold in your hand is the fruit of life. The act of kindness or the act of murder falls from your fingers. You know what you are is important. You know what you do affects others. And you care how it affects them. This is the human scale. In the perfect society, who we are does not matter. We are repetitions to one another, identical in appearance and redundant in purpose. What we do amasses like indistinguishable atoms. It is an accumulated sameness, compiled to sustain the perfect. The atom mixes imperceptibly in the common compound, but in the human scale, difference makes texture of what is true, detail that is necessary, superfluous being essential. Who sees what others do not see, sees what others cannot. Who does what others do not do, does what others cannot. The one who cannot work sings. The one who cannot sing works. The one who cannot work or sing will help those who cannot help. This is the human scale. I awoke. The morning breeze, cool, soft. I shall never forget. Awakened me, lifting a gingham curtain, brushing me like fingers, deliciously. I awoke with that. I awoke with that caress on my face, like my mother's touch. And I felt happiness I had never felt. I stood out of bed and parted the curtain which had caressed me, where the morning breeze met me in an open window, and looked out. The sunny village spread below me and away from me from that house on which I stood, a towering point at the top of a house which stood atop another house, which stood atop another house. A whole wooden town was vertically raised up, clinging against the limestone wall of the river's canyon. Stacks and stacks of houses to my right and left were piled up in tottering tiers of so many wooded dwellings, braced and bridged and trust to one another, each clasping, clinging to the cliff, perilously secured by a taut steel guy wire hooked to great iron eyelets screwed deeply into the rock. The back windows and the back doors of the houses at an arm length to the very rock itself, where sometimes mosses moldered in that shade and ferns sprouted out of the wall of it, and where water from the cliff top trickled down, sometimes showering. A hoisted city, a hodgepodge pueblo in a clever whimsy of wooden houses, stacked up one on top of the other, houses mismatched in size and shape, styles and attitudes, off-angled to one another, tipsy on top of one another, and willy-nilly linked by spreads and reaches of makeshift wooden scaffolding, leaning ladders from one house to another, clumsy stairs here and there, some ending in peculiar perches like umbrellas, like porches, great swaying swags of dodgy catwalks amongst and between them on roping cables. The houses all lightly swayed in that breeze like boats in a river. And far below me, five, maybe six stories down, I saw the great river, its sparkling course curving away in the wide berth of the great canyon. A strand of yellow sand this side, and on its wobbly waves some skiffs skipped like sprites over its cross currents, or stood among them bobbling, fishing deep with dark, taut lines baited for the river's dark depth. People, many people, milled about the shore, calling faintly to one another, and others tended gardens near a wooded grassy park beyond the stand, where I saw children running in and out at play. I was amazed by what I saw. All these people looked completely different from one another. Not a single face was the same. The old man spoke up from behind me, where he had been sitting quietly in a rocking chair, abiding my sleep. He spoke to me. He gave to me my name, the same I own now, though when he said it I did not know to whom he was speaking. The old man was William William, whom you may remember I have told you about, who was my new true father, as I became a new true person now in the village. I turned to see him as he rocked, smiling at me. I had never seen such a face, never seen such an old face with withered hands. Of course, the old are not allowed to get old in the perfect society, but are repaired physically and neurologically until they someday go for repair and never come back. In a sense, because all of us look alike as genomes and images of genomes, no one ever dies. But in the village, we die. And somehow, it is more painful and sorrowful that we die, because when we do, nothing like ourselves will ever come again. When William William died, I made such a sound out of grief. I do not know where it came from out of me. It came from out of me like a painful childbirth. And it was like something alone in all the world never known. An unconscious utterance of me, a cry of singularity, his dying so wounding me and all the world. I could not help but let it come out of me. I do not think I can bear to see your mother die. That is why I must go back, if I can save her. She's not afraid, but I am. William had opened my student bag and taken out its contents. Grandfather's writings lay on the tea table next to him. He had been reading them. I felt afraid. The wind made the house sway and creak like an old tree. He smiled to reassure me. He put his hand on the writings, admiring them, and said, "You belong here, you know." He looked back at me and explained that some of the writings I had in my bundle he had never seen, and that he knew much of it, that the writings of Antisthenes were revered in the village. I asked him if this was where Grandfather lived. He seemed puzzled for a moment, and then, understanding my confusion, told me that, of course, Grandfather had died long ago, but no, their tradition did not hold he was an ancestor, but he was revered nonetheless. He explained that there were many villages in the map. He called it rather simply the world, and that he did not know how many. They knew of one another only by commerce, where the river intersected them, or wanderers had appeared. This was not the village of Grandfather, but there were hundreds, perhaps thousands of these, where the art of living survived. "You like books?" he commented, touching now the two filthy objects I had found set beside Grandfather's writing. I nodded. "Come." I followed him to the back of the room, through a closet door, to a narrow, dark staircase that took us down in a twist to the bottom of the house, to where, in an almost impenetrable darkness, musty, stale, and warm, he took me feeling blindly through a maze of many bookshelves, filled from floor to ceiling with books, smelling of mildew, but carefully and lovingly kept. He took me by turns through the narrows of the bookcases into a space at the front of the room, where a ponderous oak table against a curtained window was set, two opposing chairs on either side. He jerked open the curtains above the table, rattled the rod with their jangling brass ringlets, shaking dust from the folds of cloth into the air, which set myriad motes of chaos into the sunbeam that shot to the tabletop. He went into the maze of books, and I turned and leaned across the table to look down again onto the scene of the working and playing people, whose muffled voices I longed to hear better. The air of the room was dead, except where the turmoil of dust in it now slowly settling. A calico cat appeared, leaping to the table to press itself into my hand, insistent, purring. The old man, shuffling, returned, carrying a large dark book. I had never seen so large a book. He held it by two hands as he shuffled toward me, and it was so large and heavy he almost lost control of it and fumbled with it, almost dropping it, and out of it sheaves of pages separated slipped to the floor. He asked me to pick these up and laid the great volume on the table with a sigh of exertion. The book, which he would show me, barely held together. Those pages slipping to the floor, where he had struggled to carry it, now pages spilling out of it as he opened it, its binding unhinged. "The Apocalypse of St. John," he said. 1498, Albrecht Dürer. The pages I held he took from me and laid them before me on the table like playing cards, and they were nearly so large as half of him. "This one," he said, "this one is the Four Avenging Angels of Euphrates. In this picture, What Christians took to be God, an old bearded man, aloft the sky, remotely above the horrible scene, looked implacably upon it. The near slaughter of the human race by four winged angels, wrathful warriors who are terrible and divine, naked swords raised above their heads to strike as viciously as they might, who so dominate the gruesome scene as to make no doubt there shall be no escape. Durer believed the end of the world should come in 1500. He fetched the loose pages and shuffled them into their proper order, tidying the corners to fit, and closed the volume. He was disappointed. He turned to look back at his bookcases. My eyes, now used to the room, saw by the edges of the tops of them the bookcases filled the room as darkly and densely as a woods. He said to me, "If you would like, you can be our librarian now." That is how I was chosen. William had been the librarian, and now he had chosen me. He said before he died that he had thought when he saw me that I must be the one. He had seen me in the days when I emerged from the vent of the transit and had watched me undetected. He had guessed that I was an outlaw because the others who were sent to scout never stayed overnight. He moved ahead of me, unseen by me, and yet, as I remembered it, the sounds which had attracted me must have been his unseen retreat. He led me by his retreat to where I had found him, by the river. Because I could go secretly into the perfect society, I was often asked to return to discover what was known about us. We did not want anything that they had, but we were afraid of them. There are even now more disappearances than there used to be, and we felt that if we could rescue those who were abducted, we should at least try. It was unbearable to imagine what cruelty they would do to one of us. But as often as I went, I never found the missing ones. They may have been detained in secrecy. They may have been hidden from the populace and not repaired, for they did not look normal. I think I knew this even when I went on my errands at the behest of those who loved the missing. I knew it must be hopeless, but the hope was all those who loved them had left. To try, like the venture of Odysseus to the underworld, is all that might be tried, for even if found, if repaired, they would be as lost to us as the ghosts at the pit of blood and milk, where Odysseus found the shade of his mother. I should find the shade of my mother whenever I return. Her face on the persons who did not know me. I should have become accustomed to it, but it caused me bitterness to see her so falsely present in these images and genomes. I know that were I one of them still, I should have actually found it a comfort to see her so, the face I loved everywhere around me, or I was supposed to feel so. The undying human whom we all are is immortal, therefore. But I found it irritated me. I found I could see what they could not, that although everyone looked alike and were essentially alike, they were individual. I could sense within them something that was not what they appeared to be, something that was private to them. Whether they knew it or not, they were individually different by being a living creature in the moment they found themselves. It made my heart ache to think how my mother had instilled this awareness in me. I should not be myself without her. It became more difficult to return as I got older, since there was a certain fashionable maturity, and I should eventually be out of fashion, and I would be looked at as odd. Of course, the image was often more likely to act out this way. Having understood that they are different, they acted differently sometimes. But this was perceived to be an emotional illness, untreated. The repairs made to them when they were unconscious, they would not know that they had been changed. So the strangeness of my aging appearance became dangerous. I went on one last expedition on my own. There was no one missing. There was no other mission. I wanted to see if perhaps I could find my father. I supposed that he did not care. He had long ago accepted that I had been deleted. But I felt reason to confront him. For my mother's sake, if not for my own, I wished to kill my father. When I came to my home, he was in the garden of his living room, where the wall showed a skin of distances, a grassy knoll, a single tree upon it, and a glory of sunlight. And wind was simulated, fragrances, birds in song. But I had seen the real, and this was as artificial as what they ate. It was perfect, and so it was false. The air was sterile. He sat on the sofa where I had seen my mother sit before they took her away. He sat alone. I called him Father. He looked at me in confusion. I came closer to him, and he did not recognize me. When I strangled him, he put his hands onto my hands. He struggled. He asked, "Who are you?" I left him unconscious. I cannot say that he was my father. And as I left, I escaped because soon there was alarm. I saw my father everywhere I looked. I saw my father in my own face, in my reflection in the glass on the walls as I passed. I saw my father in the transits sitting beside me, across from me. The alarm had been quickly broadcast. The NVIDIA messages networked to walls everywhere. The transit stopped in the tube at another station. Educators flowed from the gateway toward the transit, and so I stepped into the crowd to exit among them and went with them along the exit corridors. The smooth, enameled steel walls unmarked and indifferent until I saw a trap for a maintenance closet. As the milling crowd passed through the echoing corridor, I waited and, unwitnessed, lifted the inset latch and ducked within to hide. Because the diurnal cycles are alternated among the populace for efficiency, there is no apparent day or night. Only in the homes are nights witnessed, and these are environs of false walls. And educators would continue to look for me until they found a scapegoat or found me. But I could not be safely hidden. That is how I met your mother. Stepping out of that closet, encountering her alone in the passage, I frightened her. And I put my hand over her mouth so she would not cry out. I warned her. I think she knew immediately who I was. She was much younger than I, like my mother when she was very young. I held her hand twisted behind her back, and I told her to look calm. And with my other hand, I suggested that I held the blade of a knife. She believed me and went quietly with me. She asked once, when we were alone in the transit, pulsing to a remote city, "Why are you doing this?" She did not look afraid then, though she said she believed even then I meant to kill her rather than let her go, even when I made my escape. I told her then everything about myself. My childhood, my mother, my father. I recognized her for a genome. But in the intensity of her interest, as she listened to me, I saw a small flaw, a fleck of green in the iris of one eye. I was transfixed by it. When I stopped talking, I stared so fixedly at her that she blushed and asked me what was wrong. I told her what I saw. She looked away at the window of black blankness, pulses of blue lamps against the wall fluidly blurring as we rushed in the tubular channel soundlessly. The color pulses over her face, turned toward it. She turned back and looked at me blankly. There was hurt in those same precious eyes. "Will you kill me?" she asked. "I cannot let you know how I escaped." She nodded and looked away as tears appeared in those eyes. I took her with me to the back of the car where the panel to the coupling is found and forced her into the cavity so that I could disrupt it. The car was easily interrupted. She was surprised by the noise of it, the cavernous sound of hollow wind, motionless. I forced her out of the escape against the wall of the channel and pushed her ahead of me between the wall and the transit car. We found a maintenance alcove midway. The car reset violently and resumed its swift track with a backwash. She shuddered, and I embraced her. She did not seem frightened then. And I have always been amazed by her serenity. But she told me afterwards it was a feeling rather of resignation and an unintelligible excitement, an essential excitement of discovery, she would later say. I had never escaped so close to an alcove such as this, and I worried that the location would betray us. By chance, this was the alcove I had first used when I was a boy running away. Like me, she was astonished by all she saw. Like me, it seemed to me, she was enthralled. She said nothing as we made our way through the wreck of the ancient city and to the river bottom to follow it to the village. She said nothing. And she did not try to run away. I have often supposed that it was that flaw in her which signified. She followed behind me closely. Your mother never asked to return. She did not look back. I do not know why. But when she entered the village and she saw how all the people had different faces, odd bodies, she looked terrified, like they were monsters, like they would kill her to touch her. She clung to me as I was greeted, curious about her, asking who she was, trying to address her as kindly as they do, but she cringed and trembled. I took her to climb up the column of houses to my library at the top, to the bedroom above it where I had first come to the village myself. And in the very same bed, William was lying, dying, as it turned out. I was surprised to see him, but also glad, and embraced him, and he kissed my forehead, and asked if I had been successful, to which I had to wonder. And paused before I shook my head. He nodded. He understood me even when we did not speak. Seeing her where she had kept herself in the shadows, near the closet of the stairs, he smiled. "Come in, dear. You are safe here." He smiled warmly at her as she emerged and held a hand out for her, which she looked at but would not touch, and he feinted the motion for a gesture to invite her to sit in a chair beside the bed. Like the day that I arrived, the morning breeze along the river lifted curtains into the room. She was horrified and fascinated by his face. She relaxed into her posture where she sat, and I recognized that she must be exhausted and went down to find glasses and to bring up a pitcher of water. When I came back, I saw that William had caused her to laugh. Her eyes showed animation. They had been talking. He thanked me, seeing my intent, and gestured for her to accept the glasses and the pitcher, and her hand touched mine in the exchange between us. She herself thanked me for the water, looking into my eyes, and then William asked me to leave them for a time. I think I loved her from that moment. Loving her as I did, they would come and take her back. Many still disappear, and I have always kept her close to the village, and she, for her part, feared what I feared. It surprised me when she became pregnant, because she should not have been able to have a child. For my part, I had been told by my mother that she had falsified my signature, hoping that I might have a child someday. I had no understanding then what she meant, since children were not born in the perfect society. I saw infants only when I came to the village. I saw a birth only when I saw yours. Your mother did not cry out giving birth, just as now. She does not cry out even now. Grandfather text. Wisdom finds wisdom as a flower wears beauty. There is no perfection nor virtue that is not natural. It is not man-made. It is not taught. It is given and not gained.